material on that desk at the foot of the stairs about the case. Now I think it's at the deputy marshal's desk. So if you want to read a synopsis of the case you're about to hear, it's available. Call 98-2470-CR, State v. Is it Huebner or Huebner?
Huebner.
Sally Day, representing Mr. Huebner. Ms. Day.
Good morning, Ms. Chief Justices. If it pleases the court, my name is Sally Day, and I'm here to represent the appellant, Jürgen Huebner, in his appeal. I understand that after our case, you're going to be hearing Wingo, and waiting in the wings, there's the Zivchek case, and all of us are looking for the remedy, a remedy, if any, for those persons tried as misdemeanants under the six-person jury, whose trial attorneys did not object to the six-person jury on the record at the time of the trial. I'm not asking today for any new law to be adopted by this court. It is my belief that under retroactivity law already existing, especially in cases that have been decided in the past few years, that the Hansford decision should be applied retroactively to the other misdemeanants who also received six-person juries. I understand that under the Wingo case, they believe that it was ineffective assistance of counsel. I clearly, from my briefs and what I'm going to tell you today, do not believe that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for those counsel not to object. I don't believe that there's anything in Hansford and in the Griffith line of cases that came down that says that, despite what the appeals court said in Zivchek, that says that the Hansford ruling did not give misdemeanants who did not enter objection on the record the right to a new trial.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. But under Hansford, if you did object, you do get a new trial, don't you?
Yes.
Okay. And on ineffective assistance of counsel, even if you accept that counsel need not have challenged the law, either way, if you accept that they should have challenged the law, the real issue in an ineffective assistance case is prejudice.
Yes.
And whatever you got to say about prejudice, I mean, six-person jury is perfectly constitutional under the federal constitution. Right.
Exactly. If we're going to decide this on ineffective assistance of counsel, we're going to have to look at it under Strickland. I mean, I happen to believe that the Strickland standard is very hard to prove ineffective assistance of counsel. But under Strickland, if we're going to say that this was ineffective assistance, we're going to have to look at each and every case, then the facts of the case, to see if we can prove prejudice. And by saying that it's ineffective assistance of counsel, at least from what I understand from reading Mr. Martin's position in Wingo, it's almost like a strict liability standard. We're saying that it's going to be ineffective assistance and they're going to be remanded for a new trial. And in that case, it's definitely going to weaken the precedent in Strickland. As a defense attorney, I don't think that's altogether a bad thing, but as a trial attorney and an appellate attorney, I realize that most persons who lose, the first thing they say when you talk to them is they had ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think that, you know, the Strickland analysis made it very limited to find ineffective assistance. Mostly, I think, because of management of cases, to say this. I don't think we have to even touch ineffective assistance of counsel in this case because the retroactivity analysis that we already have, especially through Benzel and through Howard, clearly says that retroactivity should apply.
Well, this case was in the pipeline when Hansford was...
Yes, it was.
Where was it exactly?
Well, they had filed a notice of appeal in April. Hansford was decided in June. not a notice of appeal, a notice of intent to pursue. I filed, I think, the notice of appeal listing the six-person jury in August, just a few months after Hansford had been decided.
So it was in the process anyway?
Yes, it was.
In the process.
It
so
was.
Your argument is if it's in the process, it gets the advantage of him. It gets the advantage of a decided case.
Yes, it does. It does because of Griffith. I don't agree that Griffith or Hansford precluded a case that where it was not raised. For one thing, this case can be looked at more in the line of Michael L. in the line of certainly Benzel, where. How could counsel have raised an issue on for a statute that had not yet been ruled unconstitutional? We have to go into court as attorneys assuming that a statute is constitutional. In fact, I mean, in the very court, the issue came up, in the Oak Creek case where they're talking about the fact that we can't just decide, well, this is going to be ruled unconstitutional, or if I don't agree with something, if I go into court, I don't agree with truth in sentencing, I believe that part of that may be overturned. Does that mean that I have a duty and all other attorneys have a duty to put this on the record every time?
Well, even if you did put it on the record, wouldn't you have to brief it substantially? Otherwise, just raising an issue without doing anything would, I've read Court of Appeals cases indicating that's not adequate.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe Judge Crawford did the most of these cases. He was doing the misdemeanor court in Milwaukee County during that time. And he did 88 six-person jury cases, and never once was the issue raised, an objection made to the six-person jury.
So, Dave, the Hansford case itself, though, involved this issue being raised. In other words, the issue was raised. And when you look at the Hansford decision, and you go back, I think, to 3 years, two or three years after the Constitution was adopted and Wisconsin became a state, and you follow the line of cases all the way up, it's pretty hard to come to any other conclusion but that a 12-person jury was mandated by the Wisconsin Constitution. And, of course, the Hansford decision was a 7-0 decision. So do you really think it's expecting too much of counsel to take a look at the cases and raise that issue?
Well, most counsel, virtually all counsel, but the Hansford case did not raise that issue. It was a statute. I think speaking as a trial attorney and appointed counsel, where we may do one or two jury trials a year, we go into court and there's so much. I'm starting a jury trial on Monday, a sexual assault trial, where I just found out that there may be a new case on jury instructions. And I found out quite inadvertently while preparing for this. And sometimes we go in thinking, we have many, many issues and many, many cases. And there is a presumption of constitutionality. It wasn't a question of the attorney not knowing the law. The attorney knew the law of the time. And truthfully, Justice, I believe that the issue of raising it in the trial court is irrelevant. Mr. Huebner and the other misdemeanants did not make a knowing waiver, an intentional waiver of something that's a fundamental right. And the Hansford analysis, when you think of the six-person jury statute, it was written with the guidance of attorneys, of the legislature. It was, they certainly felt it was constitutional.
However, it was made apparently ignoring cases that went back about 150 years.
Yes.
And had come right up to almost the present time. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something else. The Cook case, which is this court's adoption of Griffith,
yes.
The Griffith decision, the Hansford decision, are all cases where the issue that was important, that ultimately was found to be the determinative issue, had been raised at the trial court level. Isn't that significant in terms of the question of retroactivity in this case?
Those cases all had, they were not dealing with a statute that didn't exist. In this case, this court itself, when they decided Howard, and the appeals court when they decided Benzel, those were the same type of cases where someone had a right, they didn't know they had it. It was a right that, until later decisions, in Howard was decided, he was convicted 4 years before the Peet decision, and his attorney couldn't raise the idea of, you know, nexus of a weapon by a felon. That issue was unknown. 4 years later, when Peet was decided, Howard came back and he came to this court and he said, It's a new law. It's a right that at the time of my decision I didn't know existed, so how could my attorney have raised it? And I mean, Benzel was convicted under a law that sometime later was found to be unconstitutional. His attorney didn't raise the fact that was unconstitutional because it was unknown. I mean, the fact of having a right that you don't yet know you have is much, much different than trying to raise an issue later on, maybe for collateral review, maybe years later. You might come in and want to raise an issue or brief it and say, my attorney was ineffective. Those things should be barred. And we do have cases that bar those. You know, the Escalona bar, the Caban case, cases listed by the state, all of those cases had to do with something that was overlooked by an attorney. It isn't something that most attorneys would not have foreseen. And if something's unforeseeable, especially something, this isn't something that in the hierarchy of absolute rights, they're just not all equal. But a fair trial, wow, what's more important than that? I mean, a jury trial, those are rights that you cannot waive unknowingly.
Well, but your client got a jury trial. Mm-hmm. He got a 6-person jury trial rather than a 12-person. Mm-hmm. Is there something inherently unfair about a 6-person jury?
It was found to be. It was found to be in Hansford. And I understand that now, you know, that's where we're going to revisit that.
Well, why do you think it was so found in Hansford? I mean, your position, I gather, from what you just said, is that Hansford would be a per se reversal for any jury trial of 6.
Yes.
Why do you think that? It doesn't say that.
Well, the line of reasoning in Hansford means that under the Wisconsin Constitution, Yerd and Huebner did not have the jury right that he should have been accorded. It went on the fair trial. It goes on procedural due process. He was denied the things that are the very foundation of our system. Due process, jury, the right to a jury trial, things that the most important rights we have.
Well, the Hansford case merely held that statute was unconstitutional.
Yes.
It then held that he's entitled to a new trial. It doesn't talk about prejudicial error, but it would seem as if the obvious conclusion one has to draw from Hansford is that this is error that is substantial. Otherwise, the court would have said, sure, the statute's unconstitutional, but it's harmless error, because the rules are you're not supposed to reverse unless it is prejudicial error. That's the general rule of criminal law in one of the statutes. So that seems to me to be your basis of your argument.
Well, I'm saying, too, under Griffith, the appeals court, certainly in Zivchik, and the reluctance to apply Griffith and Cook to this case seems to be that even though Huebner's case was pending at the time and fulfills the requirement of Griffith, it was pending on an issue that was raised for the first time in the appellate court. I don't see that that's a significant, you know, when it was raised and the fact that it's such a substantial right. The fact is, how important is a right if when you're deprived of that right, there's no remedy? Rights vary. And maybe, you know, maybe in some of these other cases where they were barred when it wasn't raised, well, I looked at all those cases, and those do not involve a deprivation of a right that's this important. And a right, and I may say, that is going to affect very few people at this point. I understand there may be less than 10 retrials because of this case. Because, of course...
I was going to ask a question, your numbers, and I was going to ask you when you... Rights vary and they change. You know, rights change. You're saying there are only 10 cases out there?
At this stage, it's very hard to get the numbers. And we can go on how many people appealed and how many people are still waiting in the line that at this stage haven't been revoked or convicted of something else and served a concurrent sentence. The three of us were talking. We think it's probably fewer than 10. But... it's hard to tell. It certainly isn't many more than that.
You're saying there aren't many more than 10 cases that are going to raise this issue?
The issue I'm raising today of retroactivity
Right. Certainly
can be applied to other cases. As far as the cases who did not raise a six-person jury objection during their case in chief, their trial case...
You're talking about the issue preservation.
Exactly. Those cases may be fewer than 10, we believe.
Let me ask, why does the Griffin case apply?
It applies because the Huebner case was pending on appeal. He had filed a notice of intent before Hansford was decided. Well, Hansford was in the process of being decided. And we filed a notice of appeal on that issue about 2 months later. So the pendency of this appeal began before Hansford. Now, Griffith says that, you know, a new rule of criminal procedure, in this case, it was...
What business is it of the United States Supreme Court to tell this court when something should be retroactive if it isn't a federal constitutional right?
Well, when our state decided to Cook, they adopted the Griffith rule as the ruling of this state. I also believe that we don't even have to look to Griffith. Under our own retroactivity analysis in Howard, this court decided that Howard, even after a four-year absence between Howard and Pete, the Pete case came down 4 years after Howard had been convicted. And it was in 1997, and this court decided that Howard did have the benefit of retroactivity from Pete because he didn't have a fair trial. And that retroactivity, well, looking back at our federal constitution and our state constitution, there are so many safeguards for ex post facto laws, so many safeguards that say if you commit a crime that you don't know is a crime, years, maybe 2 years down the line, they're going to pass a statute or they're going to pass a tax. They can't come back at you and say, hey, this is illegal because you didn't know about it. And that's what ex post facto means. Well, because of all the safeguards against ex post facto laws, there's certainly a presumption there that a law that's beneficial should be applied retroactively. If we're going to make an exception for retroactivity, and we're going to say, if this actually hurts you, we won't apply it. There certainly is the assumption there that all other things should be retroactive. And certainly this court looked at it, in Benzel, using retroactivity analysis and ex post facto analysis. This man was convicted of a crime, the drug tax stamp. Later on, when that when that statute was found to be unconstitutional, his attorney hadn't objected to that. And the Benzel holding was, it's only right. It's only right. If you want to look, Justice Prosser, if you want to look just at our state, Wisconsin has the Bolt case from 1888, which is probably quoted more than any other case, and it's still good law, and it's still being quoted. And at that time, Bolt held that the guilt or innocence of the defendant is absolutely immaterial. If it's found that someone did not have a fair trial, that person should get a new trial. And in Bolt, it was a case where they were arguing on the facts. The person was so clearly guilty. Our Wisconsin common law made a precedent way back then saying that the guilt or innocence, I think that's why I'm bothered by going at ineffective assistance and having to use the Strickland prong, because we're going to be looking at the facts of the case and saying, well, this outcome wouldn't have been any different. But, starting with Bolt and going for the next 102 years, we've held that our right to a fair trial is paramount before any kind of judicial or social or court calendar convenience. And I believe that we just don't have to look at Griffith. We don't have to really look at Hansford or any of those decisions. We can look at, we don't have to make any new law at all. We can look at the retroactivity laws and precedents that we have today. And talking just a little bit in the time I have left about waiver, I think it's so clear that these persons who didn't raise the issue did not waive it. If you're not aware of a legal basis at the time of trial, you just don't waive it by silence. A waiver of a 12-person jury must be made personally. It's a fundamental right. It was not made in this case. Any argument to waiver seems totally groundless. Waiver requires an intentional relinquishment of a known right. That's what our law says. That's what the Albright holding that also has been quoted in different times and still is good law today. Under Albright, there has to be an intentional waiver. There wasn't one here. I just don't see where there's any justification for not allowing these misdemeanors to be remanded for new trials. Also, the issue of due process. Due process certainly isn't optional, and procedural due process. Due process is so important that, again, in the cases where they were barred, certainly in Castile and other cases where people were not allowed to go back, it was found that even if you have a constitutional deprivation, you can only be remanded if you can prove you didn't have adequate due process. In this case, of course, there was not adequate due process because there was a 6-person jury. So under the claims of, there's really no argument that can be made under the claims of waiver, no argument that can be made really saying that the process was sufficient. Inconvenience certainly isn't a reason to deny it. Our courts have ruled forever in Wisconsin that due process is required even when it causes some inconvenience. It's not going to cause a lot of inconvenience here.
It's going to cause a retrial this day.
It'll cause very few retrials. Is that price too high to pay for fairness? What's more important, efficiency or fairness, especially if fairness can be obtained by retrying maybe 5 people? It just doesn't seem right for us to weaken our standards and weaken our laws with any arguments about inconvenience, about anything like that. I just don't believe that this is barred by any case law. I know that arguments have been made about Caban, about other cases, but again, those cases don't involve a right of this magnitude. I don't believe they hold water at all. Going back again, because I know it's going to be the issue in Wingo, of ineffective assistance of counsel, again, I believe that counsel was upholding the prevailing law of the time, holding a statute to be unconstitutional. This court said in Howard just in 1997 that it's absolutely unrealistic and unworkable to expect attorneys to raise objections to each and every law that they may not agree with and may feel that somewhere down the line there's going to be a successful challenge and that statute may be found unconstitutional. It's unrealistic, it's unworkable, and it puts a very unfair burden on trial attorneys. Also in this case, the thing that's bothersome to me is the fact that I'm proud to have spent my career as an appointed attorney for the Public Defender's Office and many other agencies, but if the public defender, if the state, if all these people knew that Hansford was in the pipeline and had much more, they all knew that the public defender was going to mount a challenge to this, and you know, we as private bar attorneys walk in to try these cases, not being told this, probably the only people that don't really know, I mean, despite the fact that you try and read Wisconsin opinions, it's very hard to keep up with. And in that courtroom that day, when Mike Orzel walked in to try this case, it was clear that the DA knew that this was going to be an issue. It was clear that when he was given an appointment on the phone to represent Mr. Huebner, the public defender's office didn't say, by the way, enter this objection. It seems that tactics like this by the state and actually, you know, by other attorneys to sort of try and preserve an issue for themselves really can't be encouraged. It weakens the integrity of our system. And to put this on the trial attorney then, I decided at the time not to bring a post-conviction motion for ineffective assistance looking at this case, and I still feel that way today, that it would have been an improper post-conviction motion to bring.
Thank you, Ms. Day. You have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
We're going to pose to Weber, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. I'd like to begin with 3 very brief observations in response to points that were made during my opponent's opening statement. First and foremost, there is nothing in this record to suggest that the prosecutor in this case withheld information from the defense as to the existence of Hansford. There is simply nothing to suggest that the prosecutor did anything wrong by either an objective or a subjective standard. Secondly, when we were discussing the number of cases that are potentially involved with the retroactivity issue, between the 3 of us, we were discussing cases that we were aware of that were already in the post-conviction stages in the circuit courts or were before this court in some capacity, either as a petition for review or some other request for relief from this court. I'm aware of a handful of cases because I've filed the responses to the petitions for review. But I have no idea as to the number of cases that are potentially affected by a retroactivity decision in the absence of an objection at trial. The only information that I could receive from the Office of Judicial Statistics was raw data for the number of misdemeanor prosecutions, the number of misdemeanor filings that occurred for each of the years in question. The totals ranged from 65,000 to 72,000 over the period from 1996 to 1999. Now, the caveat, there are 2 caveats. The first is that the counties were going to a different accounting system during that period of time, and there's not a whole lot of confidence in some of those figures. And the 1999 figures were draft figures. But all I had to work with were the raw numbers of misdemeanor filings.
Well, and the appeal time has gone for most of them, but the question of a 974-06 is not.
The question of collateral challenges has not, and that's not an issue before the court today. These cases are both in posture of direct appeal. The third point I want to make is in relation to a question that Justice Prosser asked, and I understood the justice to be asking if this court was obliged to follow U.S. Supreme Court pronouncements on retroactivity regarding matters of state law. That's what I understood your question to be, and the answer to that is very obviously no. This court is obliged to follow United States Supreme Court pronouncements on matters of federal constitutional law, and that's the Jim Beam case from a few years ago. But this court, rather Griffith and Teague, don't bind states on the retroactivity of new rules under state law.
Well, that is, counsel, but we've adopted both Griffith and Teague, so we're not obligated to, with a clear slate, but we have the Cook case as recently as a couple of years ago, I recall the Schmelzer case that you cite in your brief.
Yes.
We specifically said that for our courts here in Wisconsin, we've adopted Teague, I think, which is the collateral.
Right, you sort of said that.
We said at the last paragraph in the Schmelzer case, thus under our present adoption of the rule in Teague and our previous adoption of the rule in Griffith, see Cook at 694, the new rule of law we announced in this case,
right.
I think we said it in that
right, story. Well you said it in Schmelzer with respect to collateral challenges, 97406 challenges. That's not what we have here. What we had in Cook was a situation where we were construing the impact of County of Riverside versus McLaughlin, a Fourth Amendment issue, a federal constitutional issue, and nothing specifically in Cook that said that this court would apply the Griffith standard on a claim of purely state constitutional law. Now, in fairness, I came into court saying that this court has adopted Griffith, because I saw no indication in any of the argument in Cook or cases subsequent to Cook that suggested that this court was going to adopt a different retroactivity analysis for claims of purely state constitutional law, which is what we've got here. But that's a far cry from saying that this court lacks the authority to do that. I think the answer to Justice Prosser's question is no. This court is not bound by Griffith if it finds a basis to apply a different retroactivity analysis on a claim of purely state constitutional law.
Is there any reason to do that?
There is in a situation like this one, where if you use the three-step test of Stovall, the test that was in place before you adopted Griffith, the three factors provide greater latitude for the court to consider the impact, the effect of a retroactive application in the individual case. And in a situation like this one, where retroactive application is going to require a retrial, and frankly, in this case, where we're talking about a domestic violence situation, it's going to involve placing witnesses in the position of having to testify again at a retrial in a situation where there are no other claims of error but for the number of jurors. There's no other claim in this case that there was any error that required reversal. The only thing we're talking about here is six-person jury versus 12-person jury.
Right. Well, I understand that there may be some prudential differences based upon what we've got here, but are there any constitutional differences that make any distinction here?
Retroactivity is not a constitutional.
But we're applying constitutional rules retroactively or being asked to. So is there any difference that makes, or a distinction that makes a difference between the federal rule which we have adopted for purposes of federal retroactivity analysis?
The three-step Stovall test, the third step basically calls upon the reviewing court to identify and indicate equities in a given situation to determine whether retroactivity from a judicial perspective, from a policy perspective, is a good thing. I don't find that kind of latitude in the Griffith test. That third principle is key in a case like this one and in other cases where individuals are going to be forced to retestify in otherwise fair trials. And under circumstances where the defense only decided that the number of jurors was a problem after the trial. In other words, it wasn't a situation where the error was preserved by proper objection. And that really is the heart of our argument in Huebner, since Mr. Huebner didn't press a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
But isn't that your comment said in an otherwise fair trial? In an otherwise fair trial, then you may be able to go to Stovall. But isn't that the issue here? Is it under Wisconsin law a fair trial to have a six-person jury?
I read the Hansford decision primarily as an exercise in state constitutional law.
Well, I agree with that. But in Hansford, I don't deny that. And in Hansford, we couldn't have done it on federal grounds because the federal constitution is not violated by a six-person jury in a criminal case, as far as I understand. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Okay. But in Hansford, why we could have said it's not constitutional under the state court, but we could have said, nobody's been prejudiced, and we apply a harmless error. You can apply harmless error in a constitutional issue, right?
You can. You can apply a harmless error analysis to a state constitutional
and issue. And federal, too.
And federal.
So the court didn't do that. The court just said reversed, which means that the court thought this was an error that was substantial and prejudicial, because you don't reverse if the error is not prejudicial.
I don't know that was the prevailing philosophy among the members of the court when they reversed.
Well, then why did they reverse?
I'm assuming they reversed because of the detailed historical analysis that suggested that at the time the state constitution was adopted, a jury was a jury of 12 persons.
Well, that may reach the substantive issue of it's unconstitutional. Didn't reach the issue of if there's an unconstitutional application to a case. If it's harmless error, it ought to be just, you could have, Hansford could have said, the statute is unconstitutional. We're not going to reverse the conviction in that case because there's no harmful error, no prejudicial error, because a six-person jury, which is, I think, the state's position, six-person jury is just as good as a 12-person. Or it may not be as good, but it's good enough, right?
It's good
for
enough.
For a fair trial.
It's good enough. And if this court, if that was the analytical underpinning that this court was applying in Hansford, but applied silently, then this court ought to take the opportunity, either in Huebner or in Wingo, to put flesh on the bones and say, we lack confidence in a six-person jury's ability to decide a case fairly. But let me argue that now.
Well,
let me make that point now, because I don't...
But that argument would go whether the counsel at the trial court waived or didn't waive an objection to six persons.
Not entirely sure about that, because in one case we have... I understand you to be arguing more a plain error, statutory error situation, like in Huebner, where there is no claim of ineffective assistance, versus Wingo, where we have a framework imposed on us because it's raised in the context of a claim of ineffective assistance. We've got the prejudice standard of Strickland as a framework. Now, I'd have to think for a few minutes to decide if it's the same or not. I know that this court has had opinions on that in dissents. But it does seem to me that we at least have to entertain the possibility that the prejudice analysis is going to be different in Huebner than it is in Wingo, because Wingo's arguing it in the context of a Strickland claim.
Let's argue about in Hansford. The objection is made, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should the court reverse a conviction where an objection is made?
The court should entertain a prejudice analysis if an objection has been made.
And that's what...
If it's properly preserved.
Well, in Hansford, it was properly preserved, right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So the court, if it's going to reverse a conviction where there's an objection properly made, your position is you need a prejudice analysis? Or is it a per se violation?
I personally don't believe it's a per se violation. I think in the prejudice context, either in straight harmless error statutory analysis or in Strickland, you have to look at the impact of the error. And in a situation where you have a six-person jury, at least in the two cases that you have before you, there's nothing to suggest that there is a qualitative difference in the fundamental fairness of a trial by a jury of six as opposed to a trial by a jury of 12. And that's consistently been our position in these two cases, that the likelihood of an increased possibility of hanging a jury doesn't reflect fundamental unfairness when you have a trial by a jury of six.
So you think the bottom line in Hansford is wrong? That the conviction reversal was wrong?
I think there should have been a prejudice analysis, and I think the court should have looked long and hard at whether the defendant in Hansford was prejudiced. I can't quarrel with the historical analysis in the case, although
I
know that...
You're not quarreling that the statute's unconstitutional, but do you think maybe the court's bottom line of reversing the trial court was wrong?
I think the court's bottom line was wrong.
Weber, why should counsel have objected to going forward with a six-person jury?
To preserve the issue for proper appellate consideration, because Wisconsin law requires it and has consistently required it since the turn of the century, since this court's caseload, my office's caseload, has been steadily increasing, certainly since I was appointed to the office in 1988, and many of those claims could be easily disposed of if this court stuck to its guns on the question of issue preservation. We tell litigants that in order to have an issue raised as a matter of right, considered as a matter of right, it has to be properly preserved by objection. That certainly could have happened in Mr. Huebner's case. It did not. It was only after the dice were thrown at trial, it was only after a criminal conviction was obtained, that Mr. Huebner developed any kind of dissatisfaction with the number of jurors that he had. In this case, on this record, we can't even say with confidence that Mr. Huebner wanted a jury of 12. There was no post-conviction motion hearing. There was no testimony by Mr. Huebner or by his attorney over discussions pertaining to the size of the jury. And there are bona fide reasons why a defendant might want to proceed to trial with a jury of six. Given all of that, and the fact that we have no other claims of error in this case except the size of the jury, I find it very difficult to accept the notion that Mr. Huebner should be given a new trial in the absence, or that Mr. Huebner's claim of state constitutional error should be heard and possibly get a new trial in the absence of an objection. This court in Vollmer, in Caban, the United States Supreme Court, in Yackas, in other cases, has consistently talked about the importance of proper issue preservation. And it seems to me that this is a case where it is manifestly reasonable for this court to say, no, we will not consider the claim. You had an opportunity to object. You had an opportunity to bring this claim to the trial court's attention. You had an opportunity to avoid the issue that now is occupying the time of the Attorney General's office and the state's highest court. And you did not take advantage of that. And we are going to hold to our guns and say, no, this claim cannot be raised.
Are you familiar with the case of State versus Cooley?
I am. In the context of waiver as opposed to forfeiture, yes.
In State versus Cooley, apparently there was a 12-member jury and then a proceeding with an 11-member jury or something to that effect. And the defense counsel approved. The defendant personally did not approve, and the conviction is reversed.
And under those circumstances, the trial court should not have permitted them to go forward. But we're talking really at this stage of the proceedings about remedy rather than form at the front end of the proceeding.
It just seems to me you're asking for an awful lot from defense counsel. Statutes are presumed constitutional. We had a case here a few months ago, State versus Ward, in which we said judges can issue search warrants. So we're relying on a
Crowell decision.
Judges can issue search warrants for good faith exceptions to the exclusionary rule based on statutes, relying on the statutes. You're arguing the validity even now of a six-person jury versus a 12-person jury.
Which I'm inclined to agree with.
Really? But why can't anyone else rely on it? There are six-person juries in civil cases and in traffic cases. And the material from the Lingo case, we're citing Judge Crawford, he said, yeah, 88 cases and nobody objected.
Are they all incompetent or
what? Why should counsel have objected?
I'm trying to think of how I can improve on the three-minute answer that I gave you before. Why should counsel have objected? Because for at least as long, longer, than the existence of the statute providing for six-person juries in misdemeanor cases, we've required issue preservation in Wisconsin courts. And we've required it for a number of justified policy reasons. In the context of ineffective assistance, and again, I guess I understand that to be where you're going, we had a number of cases, certainly, where there were no objections to the six-person jury trial. That doesn't mean those objections should not have been made. In the context of ineffective assistance, though, it's a two-pronged test, deficient performance and prejudice. And it sounds like we may have common ground on the prejudice analysis. The state's position certainly has been that these defendants can't make out a claim of prejudice as that term is defined in Strickland. And I can discuss that if that's where the court wants me to go.
Well, take the first step. You think it's which has been the point of the questions. You think it's deficient performance for counsel not to have raised the unconstitutionality issue?
We took the position in Wingo that it was not deficient performance. That the defense attorney in Wingo was entitled to rely on the presumption that attends the constitutionality of statutes. In Wingo, and I guess by implication here, since we're talking about ineffectiveness in this case, is lack of prejudice. That prejudice, as defined in Strickland, requires a reasonable probability of a different result at retrial, something to suggest that the result in the trial is fundamentally unfair or unreliable, and we do not have that here.
So, counsel, help me with that. Do you or do you not expect in this case, and then I have a follow-up question, in this case, for defense counsel to have raised the objection before Hansford was decided?
Yes. In Mr. Huebner's case, I expect counsel to comply with the rules of issue preservation. I would have expected an objection to the size of the jury on state constitutional grounds, a development of that argument in the circuit court.
Okay.
Yes, I would have expected
that. Follow-up question as raised by your opposing counsel, truth in sentencing. With a broad sweep, let me say that we have perhaps half of truth of sentencing that is now law, and another half that's coming in some form. With the half that's now law, there are articles or inferences that maybe there'll be some contest to some of those provisions. And who knows what we will, if there is, who knows what we will do. So which of those provisions that are now law should defense counsel across the street at Dane County Circuit Court now be raising? Are that many, or are there a few? And then my next question, since you're resting, is of the proposed legislation, which some additional legislation will probably pass, how far do you extend the requirement of omniscience? Okay, so let's start with right now. Tell me why and how these folks across the street are being are committing error by not raising issues. What issues must they raise right now so that they can preserve an issue when a year and a half or 2 years from now something on truth or sentencing comes before us? Give me the laundry list.
I can't give you a specific chapter and verse laundry list in truth and sentencing. What I can tell you is that this court has consistently said that objections to claims of error that do not go to the jurisdiction of the court, claims of non-jurisdictional error, have to be raised in a timely manner. I can tell you that my friends in the defense bar are meeting and discussing possible challenges to truth in sentencing, just as I assume that Mr. Martin can tell you that when Hansford was in the pipeline, that the public defender's office was communicating within the office and presumably with appointed attorneys, letting people know that this possible option is available for objection. The defense bar institutionally informs itself of ongoing cases, just as the Wisconsin District Attorneys Association does.
You finish.
I understand your concern. We don't expect defense attorneys to be omnipotent, prescient, whatever term you want to use. But I think that it is reasonable, certainly in Mr. Huebner's case, when Hansford was out there, certification was out there, the existence of the case was out there, it was not a state secret. It is not unreasonable for an appellate court, for a reviewing court, to say you need to follow the rules of issue preservation. Because we have so many cases, because we want to develop a record in the circuit court, because we want to give Judge Crawford an opportunity to look at Hansford, which presumably would have been revealed in the context of an objection, and to say, look, we're going to stay the trial in this case until we have a decision, or we're going to go forward with a jury of 12 to be on the safe side. I don't think that that is so unreasonable. It may be possible to develop scenarios where you would relieve someone from operation of the forfeiture rule because so much time had passed. Perhaps your situation with truth in sentencing would fall into that category. I don't know. But it is manifestly reasonable in Mr. Huebner's case to say you could have and should have complied with the rules of issue preservation. And the fact that you didn't will preclude review of your claim in this case.
I think that if we checked all the cases on waiver, that they would have involved issues that relate to matters that are settled in court. Objection to an instruction, and it was clear from other cases that the instruction was wrong, etc. This case involves something new, that is, that this law is unconstitutional. Why do you think it's so clear that in Huebner's case, counsel should have known and should have objected because of Hansford, because of the timing that Hansford was in the pipeline? And how can you then say that there's no deficient performance? I think if they failed to object to hearsay that was very relevant, or they failed to object to an obviously wrong jury instruction, or failed to object to the instruction on reasonable doubt wasn't given, blah, that you'd say it was deficient performance, but maybe not prejudicial. Here you say the performance is not deficient. They were entitled to rely on the presumption. And yet, once you say that, how can you then argue that there's waiver? That's what's bothering me.
With respect to your first question, the reason I would obligate Huebner to comply with rules of issue preservation insofar as invocation of Hansford is concerned is due to timing. The case, Huebner was charged in November of 97. Hansford was certified in December. This court accepted the certification in January of 98 and decided the case in June of 98. The timing certainly would have lent itself.
And when was the trial in Huebner?
He was tried and convicted on February 18th of 98.
1998. So someone would have had to find out in January of 98. and then have be prepared for a trial in February of 98. They'd have to have checked the internet to find that out, probably, because that's the only way, unless they would have gotten notice of that. And then you have to assume an immediate transfer to internet, and the only way they would have found that out is to have either checked the issue statement that the clerk's office does, or have known the name Hansford.
It's my memory, my recollection, that the legal press, if you will, certainly the Wisconsin prosecutor, I believe the public defender's office, also promulgated information pertaining to the acceptance of first of all, of the certification, and secondly, the acceptance of it. Mr. Martin may be able to speak to that. But certainly,
we're talking about a month here.
We're talking about 2 months from the certification. Actually, the case had been perfected in the Court of Appeals in Hansford long before that. But we're talking about this court.
There's no acceptance until January 98.
Right. January 23rd of 98, this court accepted the certification. I mean, if you want to go back even farther, this thing was briefed in the Court of Appeals long before December of 97.
But there's no reason why anybody would know that without checking 3,600 cases in the Court of Appeals. There's no issue identification there.
Assuming the public defender's office hadn't promulgated the existence of the case and the challenge, that's correct. They would have had to have gone through however many cases were there. The state's in a difficult position insofar as the deficient performance analysis in Strickland is concerned, made even more difficult by the revelations from yesterday in terms of whether Mr. Wingle was on all fours factually with Mr. Huebner. I'm inclined to focus the state's analysis, as far as deficient performance is concerned, on the prejudice standard, simply because Strickland allows us to do that.
Yeah, the reason I'm pressing on that is because if you say that this, to my mind at least, that my immediate reaction is, if it's not deficient performance, then to say that there's a waiver, to me, just does not hang together.
The state's position on that was refined, too, between Huebner and Wingo, from waiver to forfeiture, which is the analysis that Justice Scalia in the Supreme Court seems to prefer.
Tell me what the difference is.
Waiver is an intentional surrendering, knowing voluntary, intentional surrendering of a known right. Forfeiture is the surrender of that right by inactivity, if you will. Justice Scalia in Freytag defines it better than that, and it's cited in the state's brief.
Well, I would say the difference is that in a waiver, you're going to look for the conduct of the person and clip them for it. But forfeiture is a question of law. The court just says it.
Sure, there are factual aspects to a waiver that the court can consider.
Right, but in forfeiture, the court's going to say, it's just gone. Yeah. It's a matter of law.
Because of your, may I finish?
Yes, so go ahead.
Because of your inactivity, you had this option. You have surrendered it. You have forfeited your right to assert it by silence.
Even though your performance is not deficient. That's one hard to swallow.
It's hard for me to swallow.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes. No, you have done in this case anyway, this day.
Just to clarify the Cook rule, I do have the decision in my hand. And as far as the fact that it didn't totally adopt Griffith, Cook absolutely abandoned Stovall. I mean, there's no ambiguity. The line says, we hold that the Griffith rule for determining whether to apply a new rule of criminal procedure retroactively is applicable in Wisconsin and replaces the three criteria approach previously applied in the state. There's absolutely no room to interpret Cook as saying that it applies to a specific case and that the three-prong Stovall analysis is still valid in Wisconsin. It's simply not. The point that the state made in their brief and today, too, that there could have been some reason, a tactical or strategic reason for any defense attorney to think that a six-person jury was going to be more beneficial to a defendant than a 12-person jury. We don't even need the ledger analysis to go through the whole mathematics of it. The idea that anyone would feel that convincing 1/12 of the people of something is harder than convincing 1/6, or easier, whichever way that goes, your chances of having one juror convinced of your innocence in a 12-person jury is much greater. And I can't imagine under what scenario you could have a defense attorney deciding for any strategic reason to know that he would have a chance to have a 12-person jury, but choosing deliberately to go with a 6-person jury. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the fact that the state is talking about the impact on the victims of coming back for a retrial as opposed to a hearing on the prejudice analysis under Strickland. And anyone who has participated in a Mockner hearing, which we do under, you know, under Strickland for the ineffective assistance, we have a full hearing with all evidence. All the witnesses appear, all the parties appear. There is absolutely no relief given to a victim by a Mockner hearing that's greater than coming into a retrial. Plus, I mean, I'm not even going to get into the fact that I doubt if many people are really even going to want a retrial at this stage. But it certainly doesn't hold water. And also the comment, of course, that the chief noticed the otherwise fair trial, having to prove that it's harmless error. We hold that due process is never optional. A fair trial is never optional. This can never be harmless error. And again, if we open the door to saying that something is harmless error, that's such a fundamental right, for the sake of very little gain, it's dangerous. It's a dangerous thing to do. As far as Huebner being satisfied with his counsel, and he was. I spoke with him. He didn't know he had the right. He didn't know that he had, that the trial he got wasn't absolutely fair. And there again, he felt he had good representation by his counsel. And if you read the transcripts, I feel that he did have good representation from his counsel.
Isn't that tantamount to an admission of no prejudice?
Of what? I'm sorry.
Isn't that tantamount to an admission of no prejudice?
Well, I don't think he had a fair trial. That's the point.
He apparently thinks
so. Of course, he was prejudiced, but he wasn't prejudiced by having an efficient counsel. He was prejudiced because he was deprived of a right that he should have had that he didn't have. It was very good for me to represent Mr. Huebner, because he's a man who grew up in East Germany and after reunification came here. And he's been so absolutely astounded at this case, at a case that to him, I mean, in the eyes of the law, misdemeanor cases are not all that big. And when I explained to him about the issues in his case, the issues of a fair trial, of due process, of the state constitution, of the federal constitution, he's been so overwhelmed. I mean, just by the whole fact that the importance that was given to these issues. And sometimes it's good to step out of our system and look at it as an outsider, because the issues in this case, in this misdemeanor controversy that we're deciding today, are issues that are the best part of our system. They're the things that, you know, make us all feel good.
Okay. If I could just follow up, because I see the red light is on, but I have one other question. I'm very puzzled by your suggestion that there probably won't be very many people who will even invoke their right to a new trial if we hold for you flouting your rationale here. How can you say that? Wouldn't you, as a defense attorney, advise any misdemeanor convicted under a six-person jury or by a six-person jury that they ought to take their second kick at the cat and put the state to its proof years later and see if they can't, get out from under the conviction? I mean, there must be a lot of drunk driving cases that have significant implications for third, fourth, fifth convictions down the road, and other sorts of cases, domestic violence and others, where the defendant would stand a really good chance of avoiding the conviction altogether. I would think that that would be the mandatory advice of any defense attorney. Go ahead.
Well, the experience I have representing misdemeanor clients is that, sadly to say, a lot of them have served their time by now. A lot have, were revoked from probation when they got a new offense and served a concurrent sentence. A lot of them don't want to risk. We're talking about sentences in a lot of cases of 90 days, up to 6 months.
What's the risk then? There's no downside whatsoever.
If they've already served their sentence, or they don't find them, or they, lots of them chose not to appeal at all. And they certainly won't be able to come out of the woodwork and with some sort of a motion and say that they want a new trial. I just have anecdotal evidence from talking to people and representing people, but when we're talking about something that happened at this stage a couple of years ago, most of those cases, are really gone. And I'm not sure that... I mean, I'm sure most defense attorneys would say you were convicted once, you're probably going to be convicted again. You have the right to do it. I can't imagine many people really wanting to do it. But that's, simply my opinion. I'm not basing that on anything scientific, certainly.
Thank you, Stay.